You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Welcome back to Setting the Record Straight, dear listeners. There was a 20th century historian
who was a gifted, eloquent, and prolific writer who wrote more than 20 books and numerous articles on the nature of Christian culture. He was called, with great credibility, the greatest English-speaking Catholic historian of the 20th century. Despite this, most of his books have been out of print for decades now, and graduate students today are ignorant of his work. Dawson wrote over 20 books, published from 1929 to 1975. His contentions have as much relevance today as they had when he wrote them. He challenges the commonly held assumptions about the 20th century culture and history. He brilliantly applied Christian principles to the world of historic events and saw the inner world of spiritual change as, quote, the dynamic element in history and as a real world transforming power. It is his vast erudition, coupled with his singular vision and talent to present a coherent and global vision of the different aspects that dominate the changing course of history, that have led some to consider him one of the greatest historians of our age, more realistic and convincing than Spengler or Toynbee. He was born in 1889 into an Anglo-Catholic family in Hay Castle. Dawson was an English scholar in the true sense of the word, that is, a man of leisure, much in the fashion of Joseph Pieper. He studied at Winchester and Trinity College, Oxford, and briefly in Sweden. In 1914, he converted to Roman Catholicism. Much like John Henry Newman, he arrived at Roman Catholicism through the study of history. You may remember the famous quote of John Henry Newman, who said, "To go deep into history is to cease to be Protestant." After marrying Valerie Mills in 1916, he settled down to country living and the reading and writing of history. He lectured sporadically and gave conferences in the most prestigious institutions of his country, as well as in the United States. In 1958, he was invited by Harvard University to hold a chair of Roman Catholic Studies in the Divinity School. Having returned to England due to poor health, he died in May 1970 at 81 years of age. Despite his brilliance and insight, Dawson has been surprisingly ignored in academia and beyond. Perhaps it is his vast erudition which makes any study
of his works daunting, if not intimidating.
Another reason is perhaps his insistence on drawing from the Middle Ages the key to the unity of Western civilization. Nevertheless, in no case did this contention involve the condemnation of the modern world per se, or a return to the historical past. Having lived through both world wars, Dawson's thought that something in Western Europe had gone terribly wrong. The task, he said, is to bring Western civilization back to the right road. The right road, according to Dawson, means to cultivate the spiritual foundations of society at an individual level. The way this would be done is, first of all, through the study of culture as a whole. For Europe, and thus the United States, cannot be understood as a whole by studying its parts. It is by looking back at history that we become freer to choose the path to go. Otherwise, we become slaves to past errors. Slaves to past errors. One of the previous areas that we could learn from is the Middle Ages, because they were, in Dawson's words, the outstanding example in history of the application of faith to life, the embodiment of religion and social institutions, and therefore both its achievements and failures worthy of study. In fact, during the Middle Ages, to the Catholic Church was the kingdom of God on earth, the supernatural society through which and in which alone humanity could realize its true end. It was a visible society with its own law and constitution, which possessed divine and indefectible authority. I want to note that Dawson did not advocate a return to some mythical ideal past
or the new establishment of a Carolinian sacred rule or emperor. He studies the Middle Ages as a means to understand the nature of Christian culture. As he says, we cannot leave the study of Christian culture to the medievalists alone, for they are to some extent themselves tied to the error by the limitations of their specialty. Christian culture is not the same thing as medieval culture. It existed before the Middle Ages, and it continued to exist after they had ended. We cannot understand medieval culture unless we study its foundations in the age of the fathers. We need to understand the organic relationship between religion and culture. It has been said that the center of culture is the cult, the religion. And I'm using cult in the best sense of that word. Christopher Dawson contends that it is through this realization between religion and culture that Western civilization will be able to survive. I want to say he was no apologist for capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism. The truly rich society is not the one that goes on piling up economic wealth as an end in itself, he said, but the one that uses its wealth as the foundation on which to build a rich and many-sided culture. It is a question of how much you live rather than how much you live on. Dawson wrote many books to explain how and why we lost our vision of these common values and the unity in our civilization. His concern was how to preserve the spiritual inheritance of Europe and restore a common purpose to Western civilization. In a period when the continent was torn by internal divisions, wars, and the rise of dictatorships. Now the world is different today than it was 50 years ago. Yet the essential European dilemma Dawson addressed remains the same. Something of a prophet, he stated that the European problem cannot be resolved merely by a drastic process of economic and political reorganization, which would create a federal unity, the United States of Europe. We know this as the European Union, which is now perhaps crumbling, as a few foresaw, and he did way before, as Dawson did far before it was ever established. He goes on, Europe owes its unique character to the fact that it is and always has been a society of nations, each intensely conscious of its own social personality and its own political institutions and laws, but all united by a common spiritual tradition, a common intellectual culture, and common moral values, unquote. And don't we recognize the statement, made long ago in the mid-20th century, as prophetic? It's based upon the Roman Catholic principle of subsidiarity, localism, which the current avatar of Southern agrarianism, Wendell Berry, Kentuckian Wendell Berry, recommends, so eloquently describes and recommends in his wonderful works. Dawson believed that it was only by the recovery of these common traditions and values of subsidiarity and localism, and in the strengthening of them, that Europe could be saved. Only when that people have a common moral vision can they rise above the might that makes the right or the law of the jungle. Now he was a very profound and devout Roman Catholic. Thus he was not a pessimist. He insisted on the need not to abandon hope, for history is not about impersonal forces, but is made up of the thousands upon thousands of decisions made by the local human person exercising free will. The true makers of history, the great men in history, are in reality the servants of events. Their masters are the spiritual men whom the world knew not. The spiritual men who the world knew not are the masters. The unguarded agents of the creative action of the Spirit. Of course, the supreme instance of this, the key to the Christian understanding of history, is to be found in the incarnation, in the presence of the maker of the world, the presence of the maker of the world in the world unknown to the world. The incarnation is itself, in a sense, the divine fruit of history, of the fullness of time. And it finds its extension and completion in the historic life of the Christian Church, and most especially in the Roman Catholic Church. This intrusion of God in history, the incarnation, this is an intrusion in history by God. This intrusion is the incarnation. It marks a turning point. Thereafter, man as part of a community and culture is essential to Christianity like to no other religion. The task, Dawson insisted, is for individual Christians today to recover their historical consciousness in order to contribute decisively to the creation of a new Europe of the Spirit. The great obstacle is the failure of Christians themselves to understand the depth of that tradition and the inexhaustible possibilities of new life that it contains. The works of Christopher Dawson are extremely relevant to those who want to understand the role of religion in Western history, and in particular, the Christian roots of Western history. In opposition to contemporary views, his work shows how the idea of transcendence infuses history with a wider and richer interpretation of events. He said, where faith is absent, man is divorced from reality. He is living in the dark, and all his intellectual and political systems become distorted and unreal. He shed much light on this obscure aspect of Western scholarship. It is well to remember that his contention that on the realization that civilization is insufficient, the fate of civilization rests. To emphasize this, he's saying that what we usually think of as civilization is not sufficient to maintain civilization. Because Christianity does not consist on a social reform alone, but in bringing a light into the darkness. It is a road that man undertakes, not a house to live in. It is a way. His real city lies elsewhere. Come back and listen again after the break. We'll talk more about Christopher Dawson and his ideas.
On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
Welcome back. The great Catholic scholar and historian, Christopher Dawson of Oxford and Harvard Universities, had a great deal to say about the interplay of civilization and morals. So I thought we all might enjoy mulling over some of the ideas he had on this subject. Let us look at what Dawson had to say about this. The more one reads into human history, anthropology, human culture, the more clearly it emerges that in every society there is a moral code, which is most often clearly defined, well thought out. In practically every society in the past, there's been an intimate relation between this moral code and the dominant religion. Often this moral code is seen as having its origin in a divine lawgiver, as in Judaism and in Islam. In non-theistic religions, it may be viewed as a discipline of salvation, a harmonizing of human action with the cosmic process, as in Taoism, and to some extent Confucianism, or else as the method by which an individual is freed from illusion and led into reality, as in Buddhism. But it may be asked, is it not possible to go behind these historic world religions and find a simpler, pure social ethic? Certainly, primitive morality is entirely customary, but it also closely is bound up with primitive religion or magic, if the two can be separated. A moral offense is not so much an offense against a man's fellow tribesmen as it is doing something which provokes the mysterious powers that surround man. The primitive moralist is the man who understands how to placate these powers and render them friendly. In every advanced civilization, as men become critical of the dominant religion, they tend to elaborate systems of philosophy, new interpretations of reality, and the corresponding code of ethics, of course. In every case, the metaphysics and the ethic are inseparably connected. And in theory, it is the metaphysic which is the foundation of the ethic. In reality, it may be questioned whether reverse is not the case, whether the ethical attitude is not taken over from formerly dominant religion and then justified by philosophical constructions. With regard to ethical codes in a society in which religion is no longer completely dominant, Dawson wrote that there would be a minority which adhered to the old faith in the old ethical system. But there will be a still smaller minority which adheres consciously to a new rational interpretation of reality and adopts new ideals of conducts and standards of behavior. There would be a third group. It would be the great majority, which would follow a mixed pragmatic code of morality made up of three things. One would be the striving for individual wealth and enjoyment. Another would be what Dawson referred to as an actual social ethic of group egotism or tribal patriotism. And finally, there would be certain taboos left over from the old religion culture. These are often the great precepts of social morality, for example, prohibitions against murder, theft, adultery, etc. But these may become ritualistic restrictions, habitual, like the closing of businesses and workplaces on Sunday without any religious reason. And to some slight extent, there might be a top dressing of the new moral ideals based on a rational interpretation of reality. This situation is to a great extent the characteristic of the world we're living in today. But we need to take into account a new great movement that's neither religion nor philosophy in the ordinary sense of the word, but can be regarded as a kind of reflection of the old religion culture. This is the democratic movement which grew up in England and France in the 18th century and found expression in the Declaration of Independence, and in France in the Declaration of the Rights of Man. It was based in the new naturalistic philosophy of the English deists and the French philosophers, and it owed much to the political teachings of Adam Smith. But its great prophet and true founder was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. This movement continued to grow with the expansion of European civilization in the 19th century. Christopher Dawson writes that at present it is the established religion of the USA and of Latin America, any deviation from it being regarded as heretical, and it is also a force in Europe. Dawson feels that it is doubtful that it can be regarded as a new cultural religion, since it seems simply to carry on in a generalized way the religious and ethical teachings of the previous dominating religion, Christianity. Certain questions arise. One is the development of moral conceptions progressive? Or if so, in what direction does this progress tend? In what direction? Another is, what is the cause of the changes in the dominant concentration of reality on which the change of moral system seems to depend? What are the cause of these changes? Third, is it possible to elaborate a rational system of ethics based on a modern scientific interpretation of, quote, reality, unquote? It seemed to Dawson that it was clearly impossible to have a purely practical morality divorced from an interpretation of reality. Such a morality would be mere social custom and essentially unprogressive. Progress springs very largely from the attempt to bring actual conditions and social habits into harmony with what are conceived as the laws and conditions of real life. The conception of morality involves a duality or opposition between what is now and what ought to be in the future. From the very earliest conditions of primitive life up to the highest degree of intellectual culture, the ethical standard can be shown to be closely connected with some kind of worldview or conception of reality that might be embodied in mythology, philosophy, or it might be merely vaguely implicit in the customs and belief of the society. The great obstacle is our lack of knowledge of reality. If we can accept some metaphysic of absolute being, then we shall quickly possess an absolute morality, as the Platonists did. But if we limit ourselves to positive and actual scientific knowledge of reality, it becomes at once evident that we're limited to a little island of light in the middle of an ocean of darkness. most philosophies and religions have supposed that there's some kind of meaning or reason behind the processes observable in the world.
Nevertheless, the great majority of modern thinkers, and in fact modern men, believe profoundly in the existence of progress, and not merely a progress of succession of one thing after another.
Someone once observed to me that, is life what, just one thing after another, or is it a narrative that's leading somewhere, that has a plot? We want life to be progressive.
But a progress of improvement, life moving on to an ever higher and richer form. Here is an adequate goal for moral effort. Here is a justification of moral values. Here is the true foundation for a modern system of ethics. But from a purely rational point of view, what does all this amount to? So far from explaining the problems of human existence, it adds fresh difficulties. There is a continual movement from the known to the unknown. Granted that the true morality is that which subserves progress, how can we know what it is that will best serve the unknown? There is a continual movement from the known to the unknown. Something that was not before has come to be. Granted that the true morality is that which subserves progress, how can we know what it is that will best serve the unknown? When the people of Israel came raiding into Canaan, could they look forward to the future of Judaism? This achievement was in some degree implicit in the beginnings of those people. They created what they could not understand. If they had limited themselves to the observance of a purely rational social ethic based on the immediate advantage of the community, they might have been more prosperous, but they would not have been culturally creative. They would have no importance for the future. The highest moral ideal, either for a people or for an individual, is to be true to its destiny, to sacrifice the bird in the hand for the vision in the bush, to leave the known for the unknown. This, of course, seems mere mysticism and the very contradiction of a reasonable ethical system. Nevertheless, it seems to be the fact that a new way of life or a new view of reality is felt intuitively before it is comprehended intellectually, that a philosophy is the last product of a mature culture, the crown of a long process of social development, not its foundation. It is in religion and art that we can best see the vital intention of a living culture. Some may object that this view of art, of the meaning of art, is purely subjective and fanciful. A work of art, they will say, represents simply the solution of a psychic tension, the satisfaction of a rather complicated impulse, which is of importance only for the psychic light of that individual, the artist. From the point of view of the psychologist, this may be justified. But then, from the same point of view, all cultural activities may be explained in terms of psychic tensions and their solution. Yet this is merely an analysis of the psychic mechanism, and it takes little or no account of underlying physical realities. For instance, when one eats dinner, one satisfies an impulse and solves a psychic tension, the hunger. But at the same time, one builds up a physical organism, and the results of a persistent neglect to take food cannot be assessed simply in terms of repression.
We will return to these ideas of Christopher Dawson after the break.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Welcome back, listeners. Drawing on the ideas of Christopher Dawson, we had described a problem he had identified, which is how do we, without sacrificing the achievements of the spiritual richness of our past culture, expressed in so many ways, including the arts, how do we preserve that and yet take advantage of the new knowledge of nature that science has provided us?
In the case of art, it isn't enough to look at the psychic impulse of the individual artist. It is only in times of cultural decadence and social disillusion that art is a refuge from reality for the individual. Normally, it's an expression of mastery over life, the same purposeful fashioning of plastic material, which is the very essence of a culture, expresses itself also in art. Dawson makes an interesting observation that the Greek statue must be first conceived, then lived, then made, and last of all, thought. Therein, he said, you have the whole cycle of creative Hellenic culture. First religion, then society, then art, then finally philosophy. Dawson goes on to say that not one of these is cause and the other effects. He sees them as all different aspects or functions of one life. It should be obvious that if such a central purpose or life intention exists in a society, the adhesion to it or the defection from it of the individual becomes the central fact of social morality. There remains, of course, a certain number of obvious moral duties without which social life is hardly conceivable, and they may be the same in every age and society, but then these acquire very different meaning according to the ruling principle. The offense of murder, for example, cannot have the same meaning in a society such as ancient Assyria, where religion and morality were essentially warlike, as among other societies to whom the taking of life under any circumstances and in respect to any creature is the one unpardonable sin. To the modern American, social justice necessarily involves an increasing measure of equality and fraternity. To the ancient Indian, justice involved the strictest preservation of every barrier between classes and occupations.
To him, the man that oversteps the boundaries of his caste is an example of lawlessness. There is a tendency in every entity, whether individual or social group, to stop itself, to turn in on itself, to make itself a goal instead of a bridge. Just as the individual tends to follow his antisocial impulses, so the society also tends to assert itself against the larger interests of humanity. We see clearly enough that a dominant class is only too likely to make society serve its own ends, or the laws of universal life. This is why moral systems in the past have so often shown a tendency of hostility to the actual social group. Certainly the great moral reformers have usually found the greatest opposition not in the immoral and impulsive individual, but in the regularly constituted organs of social authority and law. One of the great difficulties in the democratic system is that the force of this actual social authority is so enormously strengthened by its identification with public opinion that the position of the individual, whose moral standards and grasp of reality are in advance of his society, that person's position is at risk. At first glance, there may seem to be a contradiction between an individual being in advance of the morality of their society and the existence of a central life purpose in every civilization. But then it must be remembered that there's a great distinction between the spiritual communion, which is a civilization, and the Association for Practical Ends, which is a political society. These two have not often coincided, actually not since the earliest kingdoms of Egypt and perhaps excepting China. There's always been a dualism between the Christian state and Christendom, the Muslim state and Islam, the modern state and modern civilization. And the individual man has a double citizenship and a double allegiance. Every society is molded by the civilization to which it belongs and to which it always professes loyalty. But the whole emphasis of its activity is on the present, the actual, and it tends to regard the civilization as something fixed and achieved, as a static background. A man's social contacts vary with the richness of his psychic life. It is only in the mind of the man who we call a genius that the creative movement in the living culture becomes explicit. The ordinary man is only conscious of the past. He may belong to the cultural present by his acts, by the part that he plays in the social life of his time, but his view of reality, his power of sight, is limited to what has already been perceived and formulated by others. Since the beginning of scientific advances in the High Middle Ages, there has been increasingly throughout the world a new comprehension of reality due to the turning of man's attention once more to the powers and processes of nature and resulting in the elaboration of scientific laws. On this new knowledge and on the power of control over nature that it gives, our modern Western civilization is being built up. We find ourselves at this time less unified and less morally sure of ourselves. As the recent history of the 20th century has shown, our culture may easily end in a suicidal process of exploitation and social self-aggrandizement, where it may lose itself in the particular. Therefore, the great problem, both moral and intellectual, of the present age lies in securing the fruits of the new knowledge of nature without sacrificing the spiritual achievements of the past. Our task is to now reconcile the sovereignty of universal cosmic law with man's detailed knowledge of himself and detailed knowledge of the powers and processes of nature. If we accept the principle of scientific social planning from the bottom upwards without regard for spiritual values from the top down, we are left with a machine-made culture, which differs from one country to another only insofar as the process of mechanization is more or less perfected. To most people, this is a rather appalling prospect. Men are more often attracted by the variety of life than by its rationality. Even if it were possible to solve all the material problems of life, poverty, unemployment, war, even if it were possible to construct this technologically perfect world, this mechanistic world, this paradise of machines, no one would find much satisfaction in such a thing. At least that's what a conservative would realize. But conservative traditionalist ideas like this are usually dismissed by the progressive as reactionary. They're in fact the arguments of the conservative, the traditionalist, even the romantic. Maybe because they were first developed by the Romantics against the social rationalism of the French Revolution and the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, which I often describe as the darkening, the criticism of these Romantics was based on a real sense of the historical realities. These people had a much clearer and deeper sense of the nature of culture than the philosophers whom they criticized. They saw the immense richness and vitality of European culture, for example, in its manifold development in different nations through the ages. In comparison, the philosophic idea of a society founded on abstract, rational, technical principles seemed lifeless and empty. Today, even in spite of all the achievements of scientific technique and the increased possibilities of social control made possible by the development of information technology, the problem still remains whether it is possible to produce by planning a culture that will be as rich and varied and vital as the one that has grown up unconsciously or half-consciously in the course of ages. When one compares the modern planned society with the unplanned historical societies which it has replaced, we see that it is enormously superior in power and wealth now, but it has two great weaknesses. It seems to leave little or no room for personal freedom, and it disregards spiritual values. We see these twin defects most strongly and marked in the totalitarian states, which in the 20th century became absolutely ruthless in their treatment of personal rights. But wherever modern mechanized mass culture obtains, even in cultures of liberal tradition, we find the freedom of the personality threatened by the pressures of economic forces and the higher cultural values sacrificed to the lower standards of mass civilization. This is not a question of class consciousness, for it is not only the life of the proletariat that is standardized. On the contrary, the most extreme forms of cultural standardization are to be found in the higher economic levels. If you're privileged enough, you can notice that the luxury hotels are the same all over the world and represent a thoroughly materialistic type of culture, while the inn, which caters to the poor classes, has preserved more of its cultural individuality and local character. The older type of culture was characterized by a great inequality with regard to individual freedom. There are all different kinds of freedoms. The noble, the bourgeois, and the peasant each had his own freedom and his own constraints. On the whole, there was a lot of freedom and no equality, while today there's a lot of equality and hardly any freedom. The older type of culture may have had very little power over its environment, natural or social, but it had very clearly defined spiritual standards and was rich in cultural values. These, of course, were primarily religious. Religion is the supreme unifying force in the old type of society. But they were also cultural in the narrow sense, so that these societies had a much greater sense of style than our own.
You know what? It's time for a break. On Breadbox Media, I'm Chuck Coughlin.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We were discussing the ideas of Christopher Dawson, and it progressed to the point that we were discussing those aspects of culture related to art and the sciences. We've made great advances in the sciences lately, but the tide of the arts has been drawn out, and we seem to be in a dry period. So what does Christopher Dawson have to say about this? He notes that we have made great progress in the scientific control of our environment. But at the same time, our culture has lost any clearly defined spiritual standards and aims. Our cultural values have become impoverished. It looks as though we're beginning to witness a sort of persecution of culture, corresponding to the anti-clerical and anti-religious movements of the last century. Of course, the culture that is being attacked is not the same thing as the religious or humanist culture of the past. It is sort of a devitalized intellectualism, which no longer possesses a sense of social responsibility. A culture of this kind is a decadent and dying form of culture, and it's bound to disappear. It is all very well to say, let's dispense with culture. But that's just what has happened. During the 20th century, the natural leaders of Western culture were liquidated pretty thoroughly on the battlefield by firing squad, in concentration camps, and in exile. A tough guy may be better than a highbrow, but a society that is dominated by tough guys is not necessarily a tough society, so observes Christopher Dawson. It is more likely to be a disordered one. It's a phenomenon that is common enough in history. It's often followed by a sharp reaction, which prepares the way for a spiritual renaissance. Sooner or later, Dawson feels, there must be a revival of culture and a reorganization of the spiritual life of Western society. If man's increased control over his greater material resources were devoted to the quantitative and multiplication of his material needs and satisfactions, civilization would end in a morass of collective self-indulgence. The more natural and rational solution would be to devote the increased power and wealth and leisure toward cultural ends, toward the creation of the, quote, good life in the Aristotelian sense. For higher culture is essentially the fruit of the surplus energy and resources of society. Cathedrals, theaters, universities, and palaces Such things flower naturally from a healthy society as soon as it has acquired a bare margin of freedom and leisure. A new planned society should be more and not less culturally creative than the societies of the past. The reason it has not been has been due to our intense and one-sided preoccupation with the economic issue, which led to the starvation of all non-economic functions. A planned culture, a complement to the planned economy, would restore the balance of society, since it would devote no less a degree of organized social effort and thought to the development of non-economic functions. But Dawson doesn't leave it there, nor as a Catholic would you expect him to. If we admit the creative powers of reason and the primacy of the spirit, we have to leave room in our planned world for the intervention of a power which transcends planning. And the only place for this power in a planned society is at the summit, as the source of spiritual energy and the guiding principle of the whole development. Cultural planning requires a principle of spiritual life, without which culture becomes a pale abstraction. Dawson says that the only way to desecularize culture is by giving a spiritual aim to the whole system of organization, so that the machine becomes the servant of the spirit and not its enemy, and certainly not its master. Obviously, this is an immense task, but how do we avoid facing it? Keep in mind, he was speaking 3 or 4 decades ago, but to him the task seemed more difficult than any time in past history. But at the same time, the mechanization of human life renders it more sensitive to spiritual influence, in some respects, than the old unorganized type of culture. At the present time, this response is most evident where the forces in question are most evil. But clearly this cannot be the only possibility. And the great problem that we have to face now is how to discover the means that are necessary to open this new soulless world, this new mechanistic world, to the spiritual world, which stands so near to it. But all this requires a historical sense, a consciousness of the essential characteristics of different ages and civilizations. And when did we achieve that? When did we achieve that perspective? Dawson discusses that. He says that this development of a historical sense is a relatively recent achievement. In fact, it hardly existed before the 19th century. Dawson believes it is above all the product of the Romantic movement, which first taught men to respect the diversity of human life and to regard culture not as an abstract ideal, but as the vital product of an organic social tradition. Dawson examined the thoughts of Nietzsche, who pointed out, "The acquisition of this sixth sense is not all pure gain, since it involves the loss of that noble self-sufficiency and maturity in which the great ages of civilization culminate." He quotes Nietzsche, "The moment of smooth sea and halcyon self-sufficiency, the goldenness and coldness which all things show that have perfected themselves." Nietzsche felt it was rendered possible only by the, quote, "democratic mingling of classes and races," which is characteristic of modern American and European civilization. To continue to quote Nietzsche, "Owing to this mingling, the past of every form and mode of life and of cultures, which were formerly juxtaposed with or superimposed on one another, flow forth into us, so that we have secret access above all to the labyrinth of imperfect civilizations and to every form of semi-barbarity that has at any time existed on earth." Dawson commented on this by saying, "It is impossible to believe that the vast widening of the range and scope of consciousness that the historical sense has brought to the human race is an ignoble thing, as Nietzsche would have us believe. It is as though man had at last climbed from the desert and the forest and the fertile plain onto the bare mountain slopes, where he could look back and see the course of his journey and the whole extent of his kingdom. And to the Christian, at least, this widening vision and these far horizons should bring not doubt and disillusionment, but a firmer faith in the divine power which has guided him, and a stronger desire for the divine kingdom, which is the journey's end." It is, in fact, the Christianity above all that man first acquired that sense of a unity and purpose in history, without which the spectacle of the unending change becomes meaningless and oppressive. Marcus Aurelius writes that those that come after us will see nothing new, nor that those before us have seen anything more. Dawson points out that this denial of the significance of history is the rule rather than the exception among philosophers and religious teachers throughout the ages, from India to Greece and from China to Northern Europe. Even Nietzsche, who grew up in the tradition of the modern historical movement and himself possessed a profound historical sense, could not escape the terrifying vision of the return of all things, even though it seemed to nullify his own evolutionary gospel of the Superman. Behold, he wrote, this moment, two roads meet here, and none has ever reached their end. From this gateway, a long eternal road runs back, behind us lies in eternity. Must not all things that can run have run this road? Must not all that can happen, have already been done and passed through? And if all has already been, what of this moment? Must not this gateway also have been before? And are not all things knotted together in such a way that this moment draws after it all that is to come, and therefore itself? For all that can run, even in this long road behind, must run it yet again. At this point, Dawson brings up St. Augustine, who said that it is only by Christ, the straight way, that we are delivered from the nightmare of these eternal cycles, which seems to exercise a strange fascination over the human mind in any age. Nonetheless, Christianity does not itself create the historical sense. It only supplies the metaphysical and theological setting for history, and an attempt to create a theory of history from the data of revealed truth alone will give us not a history, but a theosity, like St. Augustine's City of God. The modern historical consciousness is the fruit of Christian tradition and Christian culture, but not of these alone. It owes also much to humanism, which taught the European mind to study the achievements of ancient civilizations and to value human nature for its own sake. And it was the contact, and indeed the conflict, of these two traditions, Christianity and humanism, classical and medieval culture, that found expression in the Romantic movement, in which the modern historical sense first attained full consciousness. It was only then that the human mind realized that a culture forms an organic unity with its own social traditions, its own spiritual ideals. As a consequence, we cannot understand the past by applying the standards and values of our own age and civilization to it, but only by relating historical facts to the social tradition to which they belong, and by using the spiritual beliefs and the moral and intellectual values of that tradition as the key to their interpretation. Thus, the essence of history is not to be found in facts, but in traditions. In traditions. The pure fact, as such, is not historical. It only becomes historical when it can be brought into relation with a social tradition, so that it is seen as a part of an organic whole. I've drawn on the ideas of Christopher Dawson's discussions of civilization and morals. He wrote about this extensively in his book, Dynamics of World History, published in 1958.
Thank you so much for listening. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com.